Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, if you're a Florida teacher, here's some good news. No matter your age, you are now eligible to get that COVID vaccine. On Tuesday, the Biden administration told states to prioritize vaccinations for teachers. Now, this was a requirement if states want to continue participating in the federal vaccine program. Here's Governor Ron DeSantis on Thursday.
What the federal government has done is said anybody that works in the school system, regardless of age. So they're able to go in these federal pharmacy sites and the federal site. You're 22 and you're a teacher. You can go get it.
Yes, this directive from the White House this week further expanded who can get vaccines, going beyond the governor's own list, which allows state-run vaccine sites to offer doses to teachers, law enforcement officers, and firefighters only as young as 50. Now, all of this may be a little confusing with the rules about who's eligible, where they're eligible, even as more and more places this week offer the vaccine, including four FEMA-supplied sites in Tampa, Jacksonville, Miami, and Orlando. Those open on Wednesday. So your experiences, your questions, heck, your confusion about whether or not you're eligible to be vaccinated, 305-995-1800. And now, Melissa, there's three different vaccines, right? The two dose Pfizer and Moderna, and the one dose Johnson & Johnson has been approved for emergency use by the FDA in the past week. 305-995-1800. Or on Twitter at Florida Roundup.
We'll go to your calls and tweets in a moment, but first, let's check in with public media reporters from around the state as they follow along with this, beginning with Julio Ochoa, reporter with WUSF in Tampa. Julio, walk-ups now welcome at that new FEMA site in your neck of the woods. How is it going over there?
Hey, yeah, well, it's busy. We had a reporter out there this morning. And so, yeah, walk-ups are welcome. But you should know that if you walk up without an appointment, they will ask you right there on the spot to make an appointment. And there's no guarantee that you'll get in. They, you know, if there's space for you, they'll let you in. If not, they might schedule you for tomorrow or the next day.
Okay. Now, as Tom mentioned, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is the newest entry into the vaccination supply. We did hear that some residents in Tampa Bay were among the first in the state to get that shot at the new federal site there. Were you able to find out how that went and what their reaction was?
Yeah, it sounds like you have a choice if you go to one of these FEMA sites. You can either get the Pfizer vaccine or get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And we're hearing that people were opting for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. They only have to go and get it once. They don't have to get a booster shot. And maybe it's more convenient for them. So that's good news that people are actually opting for it.
Yeah. And, you know, there has been some confusion, people wondering who's eligible. We've also seen private companies sort of getting a little bit ahead of the state regulations. For example, CVS got ahead of Governor DeSantis and just started vaccinating all teachers before he caught up with their protocol and widened the circle. As people try to log on anywhere and get a vaccine, we're also sort of hearing that people are lining up at sites around the state in a standby manner, waiting to see if they might get a leftover shot at the end of the day. That is happening at some sites, we're hearing anecdotally anyway. Are you seeing that in the Tampa Bay area?
That is hit and miss, you know. So we did see a reporter actually got a vaccine at a Publix who just happened to be there, and I guess they offered it. It was a leftover. But I don't think that's the best way to get a vaccine. You are better off registering with the site. And, you know, you mentioned there's confusion about who is eligible. And, you know, the federal government is saying that they want all teachers, regardless of age, to get the vaccine. And DeSantis is still saying, you know, yes, if you go to one of these federal sites, a teacher of any age can get the vaccine. But many at county sites and at state sites, they are still saying you have to be 50 or older if you're a teacher to get the vaccine. So, yeah, it can be confusing to know where, if you're an educator, where you're able to go to get this vaccine.
Sure. And there are so many choices. You know, in Jacksonville, where I sit at the new FEMA site here, they turned away nearly 200 people who showed up Wednesday evening at the end of the day, hoping to get a shot, because as we had been told, they could vaccinate 2,000 people at this new FEMA site on the north side of Jacksonville. By the end of the first day, they had only vaccinated about 1,000. So many people did show up hoping to get a vaccine. Some of them were able to, and then they sort of tightened the protocols and didn't let anybody else in. What about going forward, Julio? I mean, as more and more vaccine supply becomes available, there's been criticism of the governor for not providing more of a timetable as to when people might be eligible. We're hearing that educators at the college level have been made eligible in some formats to get the vaccine. And people that fall into other categories, different age groups, they're sort of wondering, what's the roadmap? When might they be next?
Yeah, that's a good question. He was asked that question just 11:30 today. He held a press conference in Ocala, and he said what he's going to do next is lower the age from 65 to like 60 or 55 for everybody. So he was asked directly if he's going to allow college professors to get the vaccine, and he said no. The next group you're going to see is either 60-year-old or 55. That's how he's going to do it, because he says, you know, those who are most vulnerable to this disease are still those who are older than 50 or 60 years old. So he's sticking to his guns on that. He's not looking at occupations. He's looking at age.
It's 305-995-1800. What are your questions about vaccine eligibility? Tigger in Tallahassee. Tigger, you know, my high school teacher told me it's always better in life to be a Tigger than an Eeyore. So right off the bat, you are in good shape, my friend. Where are you with your vaccination questions and situation?
It's the case that my wife found out they were giving out vaccines up in Bainbridge, Georgia. And so she called up there and they put us on a waiting list. That at 4 to 4:30, they would know how many were left over, and they would start calling the list. Well, we got on the list, and then a little while later, they called back and said, look, we'll just go ahead and put you on the appointment list. So we have an appointment this afternoon.
Fantastic. And do you or your wife, are you over 65, or do you fall into any of the categories? You don't. Okay.
No.
So crossing the state line. Thank you for that, Tigger. Julio, people are getting creative, looking for any way they can to get access to the shot. And, you know, we should be clear. The picture on this could change quite a bit over the next several weeks as we're flooded with more supply. But what about Tigger and his wife and the way they're going to be able to get vaccinated up in Georgia?
Yeah, a little vaccine tourism. We heard about that in Florida. People coming down here seeking vaccinations when we first rolled them out. You know, I did go on to the sign up websites yesterday just to see what it was like. And they allowed me to sign up and get in line. They told me that, you know, I was not eligible yet, but when I do become eligible, then I will be in line. So maybe it's worth signing up now and getting in line.
Registering everybody. Now. Sure. You know, and I've heard anecdotally at Walmart pharmacies that people have been able to be vaccinated there, have been able to make appointments there, whether or not they're eligible under the official state categories. And Julio Ochoa going to stick with us for a little bit longer to answer, Tom, our many questions that we have about all of this.
Indeed. 305-995-1800. Lots of changes this week in terms of vaccine eligibility, and that eligibility can be different based upon where you are going to seek out your vaccination. One of the significant openings this week were four, a quartet of FEMA vaccine distribution sites in Jacksonville, Tampa, Miami-Dade County and in Orlando. And there has been, of the four, the highest demand in Orlando. Nicole Darden-Creston is a host with our sister station in that area, WMFE. Nicole, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You visited that distribution facility, that FEMA vaccine facility in Orlando this week. What was it like?
I did visit on Wednesday in the late evening, and I think it was perhaps because it was the first day, but the crowds were fairly light at that time. I got there about a half an hour before they closed, and I sailed right through. I actually set out to document my own odyssey of getting a vaccine because I became eligible on Sunday. And strangely enough, it was really a game changer, the FEMA site. I got through it in about 20 minutes. Now, that has changed significantly. About the time that the announcement came out that teachers could be of any age could be vaccinated, they started to flood the FEMA site. And for instance, yesterday evening at about 6:15, they reached a cutoff point and they had to say, we have no more vaccines for today.
Yeah. Nicole, as we heard earlier, these sites do welcome walk-up participants. But as Julio Ochoa mentioned, even if you walk up, you're still asked to make an appointment. Did you have an appointment prior to you arriving at the FEMA site in Orlando?
I did not, and I fully expected to be turned away with an appointment for the next day. But there was a separate tent.
But you weren't, tent. Were you?
No, you're sent to a separate tent where there's a set of staff members that will give you. They'll register you there on the spot and send you on for your vaccine, if that's possible. Again, it has to do with the size of the crowd. So I think, frankly, I lucked out. But they do aim to have to move 300 people through in about an hour, which is what they told me that they did on Wednesday morning. So it seems like they've got a real plan at the FEMA sites. They're moving fairly quickly.
And how about the choice of vaccine? I know that at the FEMA site here in Miami-Dade County, at least if you're one of the earlier folks to show up each day, you potentially could have your choice of vaccine between the Pfizer, the Moderna, which of both are two shots, or the one-shot Johnson & Johnson, which was approved just last week.
Now, as of today, you can have a choice, but when I went on Wednesday, the Johnson & Johnson had not arrived yet. Okay. So I got the Pfizer. I was told I was getting the Pfizer, and and that was fine with me.
How are you feeling?
But now there is a choice. Well, my arm was pretty sore, I have to admit, and I got a slightly tired, maybe a little loopy for a while, but I'm quite all right. The side effects were not bad at all in my case.
Yeah.
Anecdotally, yeah. You hear, you know, also it's different for different people.
And since you got one of the two dose regimens, do you have that second appointment already set?
Yes. They gave me a card and has my date to return. And they said, just come back, show the card, and you will get in for your second dose.
And you're expected to return to that same FEMA facility in Orlando?
Yep, same site.
Nicole Darden-Creston, host at WMFE. Stick with us. Julio Ochoa with Health News Florida and WUSF. And your phone calls, 305-995-1800. Ian in Winter Haven, thanks for calling in. You're on the radio. Go ahead, Ian.
I live in Winter Haven, which is Polk County. And I don't know how to use computers, so I can't do all that. And I signed up with the Polk County, had a telephone number, health department. But they're supposedly setting it up. I called them last month, and I called them yesterday, and they said, well, we have to wait and see where it's going to be and all that. Orlando and Hillsborough and Miami and everybody else gets these centers. They're giving the shops away like crazy. But if you don't know how to use a computer, you can't get signed up for them. I mean, it's kind of like discrimination in a way.
Yeah. We the digital divide at play, Ian. I know there's lots of folks in South Florida and elsewhere that may take a point about having the shots freely in some of the locations you mentioned. There's been big demand across the state. We do know the governor is going to be in your area today on this Friday at 2 o'clock, and so maybe there'll be some news, Ian, about the availability of shots there in Polk County and in Winter Haven. But to Julio Ochoa, that digital divide that Ian talks about, so many local county public health facilities, hospitals, Publix and others have been relying on, you know, internet service in order to be registered or to be able to even make an appointment.
Yeah, it is a problem for some communities, and we're seeing that people just aren't signing up, you know, and you, if you look at the numbers of communities of color that have been vaccinated compared to the number of white people who have been vaccinated, there's a big disparity there. So different communities are trying different things to get out to these communities who may not have access to internet or may see that the sign up process is really difficult and just might not try and do it. But yeah, that's an issue that you see all these pop-up sites going up around the state, but I don't think they're reaching enough people of color. That's for sure. Incidentally, I do know that FEMA is opening a satellite location in Winter Haven. So maybe the color will be able to get a vaccination there. They're offering 500 vaccinations a day at these satellite locations.
Yeah, Nicole, we've heard as part of this FEMA strategy, which are federally supplied doses, they're in these four locations, then I believe each of the locations will have then satellite trailers, satellite vehicles to go out into neighboring communities that may be underserved when it comes to distribution. Do you know anything about that in Orlando?
Yes, that's true. We have two happening right now, two of the satellite locations, and they will change locations to another two in the coming days. Lawmakers have pointed out that the sites that take walk-ups are kind of a way to address the digital divide. You can just go there without an appointment and either get a vaccine or get registered for one there on the spot. Now, that is still not convenient for people who, say, don't have transportation and it's a long drive. But that is what offering more walk-up places may be a little more helpful for people who have a little trouble with the internet. And I think we've all experienced that at some
Indeed,
point.
Yeah. And you make a great point, Nicole. Walk up doesn't mean pedestrians. Usually it means that you've driven to a parking lot, parked your car, and then walked up to the site without having an appointment. You still have to have the transportation to get to the site. Let's take a quick call here before the break. Gary in St. Pete, we want to hear from you. Go ahead, Gary. I've got about 45 seconds.
Okay. I'm a retired healthcare professional. I live in St. Petersburg, and I'm a Democrat as well, but I agree with DeSantis tackling the over 65-year-olds first. We have to get rid of the excess death that otherwise would occur if the 65-year-olds were not being protected. And, yeah, I'm a little concerned about some favoritism going on, notwithstanding the favoritism still favors over 65-year-olds. And that's what needs to be taken care of first. I'm a little concerned about the teachers not being able to get enough access in all counties, the ones at the federal sites, because the federal sites are so geographically restricted.
Gary, we got to leave it there, but I appreciate you adding their voice to it here. Gary from St. Pete here on the Florida Roundup.
And in a moment, more criticism over Publix and vaccines and a federal investigation some are calling for. That's next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. First dose vaccinations in Florida this week hit at least a one-month high. More than 360,000 people got their first dose in the previous 7 days, ending on Wednesday. This is according to State Department of Health data. Now, this represents the first week-over-week increase in first dose vaccinations in Florida in at least a month.
Good news, right? But criticism does continue over how those vaccines are being distributed. Now, you might not have known this, but almost a quarter of the state's vaccine supply has gone to Publix stores. This week, the Miami Herald reported the state does not know where those doses will go before they send them to Publix, a private company. In a statement to the Florida Roundup, the grocery store said that the state, quote, knows exactly where the shots are administered, end quote. As we talk about this Miami Herald investigation and Publix, give us a call. Here on the Florida Roundup, 305-995-1800. Tweet us at Florida Roundup.
Julio Ochoa with Health News Florida and WSF is still with us. And Sarah Blaski is with us, investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. Sarah, thanks for your time today. Your reporting found the state does not know where the Publix supply will go before the doses are sent to Publix. The company told us it's required to tell the state each day the number and location of the doses administered. Can both of these things be true, that the state doesn't know where the doses are going beforehand and Publix is telling the state where they've been administered?
So first of all, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Sure.
And yes, that's a great question. And the answer is absolutely yes. Both things can be and are true. Publix does eventually report to the state when it administers vaccines and where they were administered. But the point of the article that we published this week was that the distribution, the weekly distribution of doses to individual Publix stores around the state, is a decision that is not where state public health officials are not part of that decision. They are not part of the very specific weekly distribution plan. They've been part of the process with Publix overall, but they don't know specifically each week where each dose is going to go. And what that means when we're talking about 1/4 of all of the doses that are not going to hospitals, so these are the doses that are going to the over 65 population, the general population of over 65 residents, this means that the state is having a hard time determining where to send the rest of its vaccines because it doesn't know specifically which communities are going to have an influx of vaccine through Publix in 1 week and maybe not the next. They don't have that information beforehand. So it makes it really difficult for them to do any sort of planning on the front end.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean they don't eventually find out. They do. As the article states.
Right. It's a question of prior knowledge. I guess that's the way I would phrase it, right? Like the state knowing where the Publix supply is going to go before it winds up in the arms of Floridians. Publix told us the state regularly reviews this administered dose data that's entered into every day in a state database. How is that information used? Is that captured in a quick enough time, Sarah, to be used on those weekly decisions?
So there's still not a ton of transparency around exactly what is collected, how quickly it's collected. We were told by the state that data is HIPAA protected and so not open to public records. That is something we're interested in talking further about in the future. But what I can tell you is this.
HIPAA,
I mean,
for folks not in the weeds on healthcare, HIPAA is the federal law that protects health information at the level of the consumer. So in other words, you know, my health issues can't be released publicly without me saying okay.
That's correct. Thank you for making that clarification. And, you know, to go to this point, the way that data is used to inform the distribution plans for any given week, our understanding of the process described by state officials is that they take the previous week's data of allocation. So when Publix uploads, you know, we've given this many vaccines at this one location in Palm Beach County, for example, they will use all of that data to try to estimate where Publix is going to send the next week doses. And based on that, they try to distribute the rest of their weekly allocation evenly. But the problem is Publix doesn't always keep the same stores open. So it makes that calculation very difficult, even under the best circumstances.
Sarah, we're going to take some phone calls here in a moment, but how are other states handling this distribution of state-supplied or state-decided vaccine supply?
We wondered the same thing. And what we found out is it really depends on the state. But generally speaking, it seems like there is some state oversight. So there's usually some sort of conversation each week, whether it's a survey that happens in some states, we understand, or something where the vaccine, the private retailer that is distributing the vaccine, be it Publix or Giant Groceries or CVS, Walgreens, you name it, they will have a conversation with the state government. Say, we could use this many doses in these areas, and then either the government sends the doses directly to those stores so they know where they're distributing them because they are distributing them directly, or at least they have the information beforehand of where those vaccine doses are going to go.
Here on the Florida Roundup this Friday, we're talking about a Miami Herald investigation into how Publix is a major player in the distribution of vaccines around the state. A full 25% of the doses are going through Publix stores. Questions of transparency, knowing where the doses are going. That's what we're talking about right now. By the way, here's a tweet from John. I'm not too worried about getting vaccinated, but if they throw in a PubSub, sign me up, he says. I don't know, maybe they ought to combine the two. But let's go to Charles in Jacksonville. He got his vaccination at a Publix store, he says. Hi, Charles. You're on the Florida Roundup.
Hey, it's great to be with you guys today. I took my mom to the Regency location a couple of weeks ago. You know, she's 85, no problem. She got her Pfizer, and I was working every station in there heavily. Say, you guys, I'm her caregiver. If I die, you know, there's nobody there. So I worked everybody, and I said, what about the spares I keep hearing about? She said, come back at 3:30. So long story short, I went to the Publix that same afternoon to do some shopping, and I saw my pharmacist, and I said, say, you guys going to be taking registrations for a vaccine soon again? And he says, well, Charles, if you don't mind waiting, nudge, nudge, I can put you on the list. And I said, well, Mr. Pharmacist, put me on the list. And I thought that would take some time, you know, and I said, I'm going to go ahead and go shopping. And 10 minutes later on my cell phone, I get a call. Hi, this is Morgan at the pharmacy. Do you want your shot now, Charles? And I said, yeah, be right there.
And off you went.
Shot on Morgan Internet.
Yeah. All right, Charles. Hey, I'm happy to hear you got your shot. And, you know, Sarah Blasky, on the face of this, it seems like a nice public-private partnership between the state and public stores to get more shots into more arms. At the same time, there are issues of equity in the lack of understanding the data more fully. Public stores tend to be situated in more white and middle class neighborhoods. So did your investigation look at that, the way this distribution system is affecting the equitable distribution of vaccines?
Absolutely. And without the actual location-specific data, it makes it hard to make any definitive, analyses of exactly how much this affected any particular community. But what I can tell you is the public stores that opened first were in communities that tended to be whiter and more affluent than where some of the Publixes that are open now are. There's actually been a greater distribution across the state to Publix in various zip codes that does appear to be slightly more equitable. But what you'll also find is that Publix doesn't reach rural communities as well. It's certainly not, it is not the entire solution. That is not to say that it hasn't been helpful to the communities where it exists. And there are many people that have gotten vaccines through Publix and they've had a good experience doing that. It's more about the totality of the plan. And one thing I wanna point out is that while Publix is receiving about 23% of those doses intended for the general 65 plus population, those little pop-ups that you hear about, the churches, those community centers that are specifically supposed to be solutions or part of the solution to reaching underserved communities, those pop-ups cumulatively are getting about 4%, less than 4% of the weekly allocations, at least during the month of February. And so you, when you're looking at that and you're not seeing the kind of volume of vaccines into underserved communities that you're seeing to public stores, right? And so that makes you start having these questions about the equitable distribution. And of course, we see some counties have higher vaccination rates in their over 65 population, some have lower. It does not track perfectly with where Publix exists or where they have been offering vaccines, but it does just visually, you know, we published some maps on the Miami Herald article. You can look at them. Yeah. It does visually, there is some visual consistency, I think is the best way you can say, between areas with higher rates of vaccination and where Publix has been.
Sarah Blaski is with us, reporter at the Miami Herald. Julio Ochoa with Health News Florida and WSF still with us. Your phone calls again, 305-995-1800. Allison in Delray Beach, you're up next. Thanks, Allison. You're on the radio.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about the support staff for the school district. I work for a very large school district, and I am in multiple schools per day all over our large county. So I'm wondering how we would be categorized, even the 50 and over population, if we would be considered as the teachers are.
Great question, Allison. Julio, I'll put that to you. We talk about teachers being eligible for vaccinations and this directive coming out of the Biden administration's Health and Human Services agency this week, telling states if they want to participate, continue to participate in the federal vaccine distribution, they have to open up for teachers regardless of age. Does that expand and extend to all school staffers or just classroom teachers?
Yeah, from what I understand, Joe Biden's order basically prioritized all school staff and child care workers for vaccines, regardless of their age. So that would include just anybody who's in school staff. And I believe, you know, if you go to one of these federal sites, that you have to show, you do have to show that you are eligible by showing an identification. But I believe staff is included in that.
Staff, teachers, faculty, all those folks eligible for this under that federal directive that came down this week. You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
And as we continue talking about the vaccine rollout, two top state Democrats, Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried and Senate Democratic Leader Gary Farmer, separately have called for an FBI investigation into allegations that Governor DeSantis has used the state's coronavirus vaccination initiatives to direct vaccines to select communities, particularly very affluent ones down in South Florida, in exchange for political contributions. We should note that the governor denies this. But Julio Ochoa, what about these calls from the governor's political opponents for an FBI investigation? They're accusing him of linking vaccine access to political donations.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen some very good reporting on this throughout the state, definitely coming out of the Miami Herald down in South Florida. The Key Largo site, where they offered vaccinations to a very wealthy community down there. And it just kind of makes you scratch your head. Like, how are these decisions being made where these vaccinations are being offered in that Key Largo site? There were contributors to DeSantis who apparently were vaccinated. So Democrats are definitely want some answers on this. And I think I don't know if this is political posturing or if we'll actually see an investigation.
Right.
Happen, but stay tuned.
Yeah. Whether it's just a partisan political posturing, Sarah Blaski, or whether this has to do with genuine concerns about vaccine access. It certainly hasn't been unusual for senior communities and affluent communities to have these types of vaccine drives where the majority of people are 65 plus. So we do need to be clear about that. But since you've been investigating vaccine access around the state, what's your reaction to these calls for a federal investigation?
I think we all want more information on how these decisions are made and, you know, specifically who is making decisions. It seems quite clear to me that we don't know. Sometimes we don't know in the public's case because the data that the state collects is incomplete. They ship a bunch of vaccines to a public's warehouse and then don't find out what happens till later. But I'm also curious about the vaccines that are distributed to hospitals and other county-run sites and how ultimately, you know, distribution happens from there. There isn't a ton of transparency, and I think everybody wants more understanding of how the shots get called here. No pun intended.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. People are just so hungry for information. There's always going to be accusations of unfairness and arbitrariness as to who's getting the shots and what the roadmap is. But certainly people are really wanting to know who's next in line, what the roadmap is, what the timetable is, and if there's at least a good faith attempt at equity and fairness in distribution. So I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Sarah Blasky, reporter with the Miami Herald, Julio Ochoa with Health News Florida and WUSF, lending their insights to the Florida Roundup this Friday. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come on the Florida Roundup this week, we're going to switch topics a little bit and talk about the state legislative session. It was gaveled into session this week, and on the agenda, sea level rise and flooding. We'll talk about it next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for supporting public media. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, the state legislative session got underway this week in Tallahassee. Lots of items on the agenda. But this is noteworthy. This year, lawmakers are acknowledging the reality of climate change and sea level rise. In fact, sea level rise actually made it into the governor's State of the State address. Governor DeSantis wants the legislature to create a new resiliency program to direct state spending.
Through this initiative, Florida will invest $1 billion into projects that will help our communities adapt to the threats posed by flooding from intensified storms and from sea level rise.
Environmentalists and scientists have been sounding the alarm for decades, but Florida Republicans recently acknowledged climate change at the Capitol level with Governor Ron DeSantis, creating a Senate committee just last year to address sea level rise and naming a chief resilience officer to lead the charge.
Now, this session, some advocates for the environment say while the big move forward on climate is good for the state, Florida needs to do more than just address the symptoms of climate change, but also deal with its root causes and get serious about moving toward clean energy. Aliki Moncrief joins us now. She's the executive director of Florida Conservation Voters. Aliki, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Melissa. I'm glad to be here.
Florida, the most vulnerable state in the nation to climate change. Give us a call with your thoughts all over the state. 305-995-1800. Tweets to @FloridaRoundup. So, Aliki, as we heard, the governor wants to spend big on environmental programs and projects to protect Florida cities from inland and coastal flooding. Your group argues that this is helpful, but say it doesn't go far enough. So in your view, what should the state be doing to not only adapt to climate change, but also reduce emissions, which is the driver of the problem?
Melissa, you're exactly right. You know, making sure that communities are adapting to the changes that we're already seeing, the flooding that's already happening, the changes in temperature and rain patterns is really important. But we have to deal with the problem that's causing all of these terrible symptoms, and that is shifting our economy, shifting our state to a clean energy economy. Right now, we get less than 5% of our energy in Florida from the sun, even though we are the sunshine state. We are overly reliant on gas. 70% of our energy comes from gas, which is contributing to climate change. So, you know, I don't know if we want to get into some details. There are actually some really good bills and great ideas that have been filed at the legislature this year, bills that would require us to figure out a path forward to 100% clean energy statewide, you know, bills that would also in the meantime help customers who are late on their bills, late on their electricity bills, making sure that they're still able to keep the lights on while we're dealing with this pandemic. So there's some good ideas out there. And, and the big question mark is going to be, will leadership in the legislature let these good ideas move forward?
Right. There have been proposals put forward by Democrats who are in the minority in the legislature to develop this statewide plan to go fully to clean energy by 2040. And achieve net zero carbon pollution emissions by 2050, a 30-year timetable. That is something that the Biden White House has also talked about, getting to net zero by around that time. How to get the state there? This is expensive, and there isn't a lot of political will in this state, despite, as you said, the fact that we are quite vulnerable here in Florida, and we do have abundant sunshine. So how does your organization advocate for this with lawmakers?
Well, part of what we do is, you know, we try to lend our weight and we try to connect citizens to lawmakers who are advancing some good bills. So just to give you an example, and this may sound small, but it's one of the ways that we can actually achieve that lofty 100% clean energy goal. And that is, you know, we've got a bill, Senate Bill 1360, that would basically create a pilot program to make sure that we are looking at using solar panels and battery storage on emergency facilities, you know, on emergency facilities, on wastewater treatment plants, assisted living facilities. I'm sure folks still remember that when Hurricane Irma hit Florida, there were people who died in assisted living facilities because they weren't able to get power. And so Senate Bill 1360 is an example of a bill that can actually, in a concrete way, start to move us towards innovative solutions for clean energy. You know, you already mentioned House Bill 283, Senate Bill 720. This is that renewable energy bill, the 100% bill, that also includes, it actually defines environmental justice. It includes some language on green job training. Mm-hmm. So these are bills that have been offered by the minority party. But, you know, we're in an all hands on deck moment in Florida. People, vulnerable communities, we can't wait any longer.
Thank you so much for that.
Really bold action.
For bold action. Aliki Moncrief, thank you. She's the executive director of Florida Conservation Voters.
Chip LaMarca is a Republican in the Florida House representing parts of northern Broward County. He's also a member of the House Environment Subcommittee and sponsor of the bill the governor mentioned in the State of the State address that would create this Office of Resiliency. Representative LaMarca, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
What's the priority for this office if it is created?
Well, you know, my bill and just kind of following up a little bit on the previous conversation, mm-hmm. I come to Tallahassee and, you know, I don't spend my time trying to figure out what the previous governor or legislative members did or what they admitted or what they labeled things. You know, I come there with a record from 8 years on the county commission in Broward County and 6 years in my city of Lighthouse Point worrying about these issues and, you know, not worrying about admitting something exists when it's 2 feet up above the level. And literally this position, to get back to your question, this position or these positions, the chief resiliency officer and the chief science officer were at least the CRO was created already under Governor DeSantis.
Right.
But this would put it in statute. And it's important. I mean, we have to have somebody who believes in science and doesn't allow the politics to get in the way of doing good policy.
Representative, let me remind folks that you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. But is the priority of the legislation creating an office, creating a position? I mean, you know, what's what once those if that happens, Representative, what's the priority for those people who fill those offices to do for the state of Florida regarding resiliency?
Okay, so there's multiple efforts, and in my bill, Resiliency House Bill 315 basically creates that office of the Chief Resiliency Officer, which would chair the Sea Level Rise Task Force. The Chief Science Officer would be the vice chair, both under DEP and appointed by the governor. And then there are members on the committee from both one from the Senate, the House, Department of Transportation.
Right, but I'm sorry, but time is real tight here, Representative. So I apologize for interrupting. But what is it that you want to charge them doing?
Right. You're asking me what I want to charge them to do, but it's important to understand that a lot of our agency is going to be involved with this. The charge is to deal with the actual impacts of sea level rise dealing with issues. I'm from coastal Broward. I mean, we have coastal issues, flooding. We have non-storm surge flooding. We have dry day flooding. We have all these issues we're trying to deal with. And I think it has to come from a statewide perspective of whether it's sea level rise issues, dealing with sea walls. Yeah. Hardening our beaches and things like that. So we want to actually get to the meat of the problem and not sit around and talk about it anymore. We want to get things done.
One of the meats of the problem, of course, is the underlying cause of warmer oceans, wetter storms, more mm-hmm. rainfall, of course, carbon emissions. Would you support efforts to have the state reach zero carbon emissions at some point in 30 years, for instance?
Well, at some point in 30 years, two different things. I'd like to look at what we're doing and, well, it is. I mean, yeah. When I served in Broward, I was very, very proud that Florida Power and Light went to all natural gas instead of
still a fossil fuel, though. Yeah. Still a fossil fuel, though.
All right. So let's make the determination: is it cleaner than the previous fuel? I mean, we have to get there in steps. I mean, you've got Democrat senators from Montana who don't believe in what we're doing on some of these issues. I believe in getting to the meat of the problem and fixing it. A lofty goal that the federal government wants to do, you know, we can probably adhere to parts of that here in Florida and come up with pragmatic ways to roll it out.
So parts of clean energy, in other words.
Correct. Clean and cleaner, and every step in the right direction is a step that we're getting better.
One other last question here, Representative, before our time is out. This office will develop recommendations around, adapting to the effects of sea level rise. Will state agencies, right, such as the Department of Transportation, be required to follow those recommendations?
I would certainly advise that they would. DEO, DOT, other agencies that are dealing with actual infrastructure projects mm-hmm. that would be better if we follow our sea level rise predictions and other things. I think that's how it works. I mean, my background's construction engineering. I basically, right, there's a plan to do something, you implement it.
Yeah. Yeah. Always look at those blueprints, right, Representative?
And it depends on. That's a good advice. Good advice.
Well, as long as those blueprints, in this case, you know, follow the recommendations that come out of the Sea Level Rise Task Force, and if there's that requirement. I appreciate your time here in this first week, a busy sure. week of legislating, I'm sure, in Tallahassee. Representative Chip LaMarca, Republican in the Florida House, represents Northern Broward County. He's also a member of the Florida House Environment Subcommittee and sponsor of a bill that would create the Office of Resiliency in the state of Florida.
Thank you.
And of course, Tom, you know, the legislature, the big thing they'll be looking at is COVID relief, along with a host of other issues, which we'll continue to cover on Fridays right here on this show. And so with that, we want to thank you, Florida, for listening and engaging today on the program. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are the producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming, the Director of Radio Operations in Miami, and our technical supervisor is Peter Mertz. Engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Richard Ives answers the phones. Our theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great weekend. We'll be back next Friday.